This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. And Jonathan, I just have like one question for you.
Yes, Ramon.
Are you tired of winning yet?
I am so tired of winning, Ramon. I'm so tired. I can't believe how much winning there is.
God, Emperor Trump has done it again.
I never knew there would be this much winning, actually.
So, I mean, for those who don't know, so 3.7% unemployment rate, the lowest since 1969.
Yeah, it basically, every time they release the stats, they basically have to go back like 10 years further to see how low it was. It's pretty soon, it's just going to be the lowest ever, essentially.
I think so. And I still, do you know why? Because he's done tax reforms, but like what do you think is the reason?
I think people have confidence in the way he runs the market. I think that it's very underreported, but the deregulation of things has allowed business to flourish.
Oh, that's true, that executive order. Yeah.
You know, the thing is there is some truth to the fact that the president doesn't have ultimate control over the economy. In fact, there's a lot of truth to that,
sure.
Which is why people want to still credit Obama with these things, for example. But certainly he's come in with a far more open free market view. The people he has around him have free market views to the way they do things. And the only thing that hasn't really been very free market has been the trade war stuff.
Yeah.
But other than that, business likes the way he's gone about things and the way the people he's appointed have gone about things.
Yeah, there's just a lot of confidence in his abilities or the administration's abilities.
Or the fact that government won't get in the way. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's not even that it's Trump. It's that this guy doesn't seem to want to interfere with the way we do business. And so, cool, I'm going to hire more people. I'm going to expand my business. I'm going to invest more, et cetera, et cetera. And that's really what you're seeing across pretty much all the indicators in the U.S., whether it's jobs, whether it's a stock market, whether it's company growth, or consumer indexes and confidence. All of that stuff seems to be on that.
Yeah, I mean, the one trick he is missing, though, is that he must do away with the requirement of experience to get jobs. Because I thought that was an excellent piece of policy at this job summit, you know, which is going to create 300,000 jobs a year just by agreement.
Mm.
And one of the considerations is, you know, people actually don't need experience to get a job. It's a colonial construct that needs to be done away with. And I think if Donald Trump adopts that, unemployment will be record lows since like 1852.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's just this, the whole, bringing it back to our side of the world, the whole job summit is just it's a terrible idea in itself, because the notion that you can get into a room and you can decide on any strategy really that is other than we're going to allow businesses and private individuals to make agreements between each other and that will cause growth in the economy. Other than that, there is no other strategy to creating jobs. You don't actually even create jobs. Jobs, it's not a thing.
No, I know. I know. You can't. I mean, you can create jobs by, you know, allowing road workers to dig holes with spoons.
Sure. And you can have an inefficient public health system, for example, where you employ people, and we have 3 million public servants in this country. So those are jobs created by the government. But if those jobs were managed by Discovery Health, for example, that'd probably shrink down to a third of that. Well, at best.
Yeah. No, but if you have a job summit and five commies in the front are the reasons why we're in a recession, and you need them to create jobs, and you need unions to come in and join the job summit to create jobs. I mean, what are these people thinking? It's a remarkable blind spot.
And let's be honest, unions are probably the single greatest reason why we have a job problem and an employment problem in the country.
You can blame the government, the shit education system, the tripartite alliance, the fact that commies control the finance and trade and industry.
The labor laws, which were the union, the state enterprises.
But I mean, yeah, anyway. So we need more Trump, less bullshit. Yeah. Unfortunately, we're going to have much more bullshit.
And you wanted to just hit on the EFF basically chasing everything they possibly can find every time the smallest whiff of, I suppose, racism.
Right. I mean, what this idea is in my head, and our guest is more than welcome to join us on this. So our guest is Ian Cameron, who does something at AfriForum. I'm still not too sure why.
You see, that's the consummate professionalism you've come to expect from the Renegade Report. He does something. Something doer at AfriForum, Ian Cameron. Is that
you could say something. It's quite a few somethings that we're responsible for. So I'm the head of community safety at AfriForum. And my team is responsible for creating community safety structures across the country. Across the board, we also then have a trauma team that's involved in victim support.
Right. So you're creating a parallel state, which as an anarchist, I fully agree with. I'm joking. You're not creating a parallel state.
No, who said that?
That's the accusations against you. And I'd be like, yeah, that's fine. I think that's a meritorious thing to do. But I want your opinion. So the EFF was at... King's William, some shithole, I don't know, King William's Town or something or other. And they physically barge into businesses, demand to see the owners, and then accuse them of racism for paying workers too low. Or
was this before or after they decided Sacha Martinengo was a racist for using we're not allowed to say it anymore, the M word?
I think it's at the same time.
Oh.
But they just barge into like fast food joints.
Or just after Malema shot 7 rounds with an AR into the air.
Yeah, but I mean, the EFF on this witch hunt where they barge into businesses, demand to see the manager under duress, and then they say, well, our demands are this. And then the manager is like, well, I'm just employed here. I don't know anything. And if the demands are not met, and it's often demands around pay of the employees and shit like that, if the demands are met, they literally like trash the store and force it to close down. And my question is to Jonathan and Ian, isn't it a bit strange to have this sort of, you know, witch trials of 2018 where we decide who should be paid what in private businesses?
Well, isn't that what the mafia did in the US?
But where will this lead to, right? I mean, it's not a good thing for anyone.
It's not going to – I don't think it'll change anytime soon at the rate that it's going now. It's growing across the country. We can just see on our side – the amount of times, for example, let's take land grabs. You go to a certain place, you just rock up there, regardless of who the landowner is, you say you're taking the land, regardless of any form of law, the cops can come and warn you, they just stay. There's just a total arrogance of this extremist type of approach. And it's funny that they want all the benefits of capitalism or a free market, but they're not willing to work for it.
Yeah, it's a sort of white supremacy argument in a way, because... they keep saying, you know, whites must share, instead of let's create our own and compete against you. Even though business is not like race based by any means, but it's this weird, very weird victimhood complex where we're not going to, you know, create our own networks and, you know, buy our own land or do something like that. It's always I must take what others have, and that doesn't lead to any sort of joy for anyone.
I mean, we also got a situation where the incentives have been set up like that. So, you know, you talking about people coming and land grabbing and the cops come and warn them. I mean, that sounds insane to me. If someone came onto my property, firstly, it's trespassing. So if I consider them a threat to me, I should be able to do more than just warn them. And second thing is, okay, they've come onto the property. They're not kind of doing anything specific, but they're on my property. I would think if I call the cops would arrive and remove them. That would be the obvious kind of thing.
And that is the logical thing to...
Well,
to
not do. Only the logical, surely that's the legal, like in the law. But here we have a situation where that's not what happens. So why wouldn't you invade someone's land? Because, well, no consequence. It's like, you know, crime, we talk about often, we must get into crime with you because it's part of what you deal with. And where's the consequence for a lot of crime that happens? We hear, you know, we all know about high-profile cases because I suppose the person is known often. So let's use this dross rapist as an example. They know who the guy is. There seems to be some video evidence, and certainly it seems to be pretty obvious. Yeah, I mean, he's an alleged rapist at this stage, but it seems to be pretty obvious that he is a rapist and he's going to be convicted, hopefully, and sent to prison for a long time. And I suppose people want to see that the justice system works at some level. But 20,000, 21,000 people are being killed a year. Is that about correct?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure of the 21,000 homicides, how many we're solving. If I had to take a giant guess at that, I'd say probably less than 15%.
It's even less. Let me just give you some insight. It's actually shocking. It's not positive to hear. I wrote an article about 2 weeks ago where I compared prosecution figures to arrest figures. Okay, so the cops in the last financial year, there's about let's say 21,000 as a max, between 20 and 21,000 murders in a year. For the past 6, 7, 8 years, there have only been about 3,000 successful convictions through the National Prosecuting Authority for murder. Okay, per year. So. Obviously, some of these murders are old murders. If you know what I mean, they could have been committed a few years ago.
Mm. And but it takes time to go to court and all that.
Exactly. But the fact of the matter is the murder rate for the past 7 years has increased with 1,000 murders per year for the past 7 years. So it literally went 16, 17, 18,000, 19,000, and it increased like that annually. And with that, we're not seeing an increase in prosecution rates. So the prosecution rate is still drastically lower than the murder rate. So
is it flat?
It's flat. Pretty flat.
And that's murder. I would imagine rape is no different story.
Or even worse.
It's even worse.
Grievous bodily assault, harm, all that kind of stuff. Those crimes, hijackings, armed robberies. So frankly, if you want to do anything in this country, whether it's from land grab right down to murder, to rape, to whatever, what should stop you, really? What's other than if you're a person who has a conscience and goes, well, that seems to be wrong because my parents told me that. But let's say you didn't have parents, specifically a father figure in the house, and you were never really taught these things and how to be a real man. Well, what's to stop you? Because your chance of being caught actually seems to be slim as hell.
Exactly. I had a discussion a few years ago specifically at a murder scene with a cameraman from a specific media institution, and I've known him for years. It's a black guy, awesome friend of mine, and we've spent a lot of time together on these scenes. But what I noticed of him, and for his sake, I'm not going to mention his name now. But what I noticed, and we were having lunch afterwards, I said to him, "Yes, why do you not ever look bothered? You just like go for lunch afterwards, and it's all good." And he said, "No, it does bother me." He says, "But I've been exposed to so much since." Obviously, this was a long conversation, but the fact was, he's been exposed to so much for such a long time, and he says that he saw his first necklacing when he was 11 years old. So if you are exposed to that type of violence at a young age and it constantly happens, obviously you're going to have a pretty bad backlash psychologically than the average, or what we call average, person would. So there's a massive ethical, moral problem with the way violence is committed in South Africa, and we've become desensitized to a lot of it.
Oh yeah, hugely. Absolutely. No, hugely. I mean, 106 rapes a day. A day. And in America, they focused on a purported sexual assault from 36 years ago that may or may not have happened, and that dominates the news.
And those 106 a day are only the cases that get opened, okay?
Right.
So they say only about 30% gets reported, if not less.
So there's over 300 rapes a day.
Exactly.
Perhaps.
Exactly.
Yeah. So quite horrific. And about desensitization, I mean, that's absolutely spot on. I think all South Africans are somewhat desensitized. We actually had a discussion in our Facebook group not too long ago, an American listener who sort of said, look, you know, I hear a lot of stories and kind of how bad is it? And it's always difficult how you frame that, because as South Africans, I mean, we live okay lives and we'll go home tonight, hopefully, you know, but chances are quite good. We'll get home and nothing will be wrong, and we'll have a good night and we'll eat some dinner and all the rest of it. But if you tell an American, for example, that, yes, but on my way home, I will be checking my rearview mirror just to check I'm not being followed. And when I drive into my driveway, I won't like turn into my driveway. I'll wait because, you know, then I can always drive away if someone comes at me with a gun. And once I'm inside, there'll be an electric fence maybe, or there's barbed wire. There's maybe CCTV cameras if you have that kind of setup, or there's an armed security service, and I've got beams all over my house, similar to kind of what the White House has, because most houses in the United States don't have – our security systems are actually very advanced.
World class.
Yeah, we actually inform the world on security for a lot of these things. So then they start going, wow, that's – like mad. So we are quite desensitized. You know, I obviously see a lot of the effects of violence from the medical side of things, and you're completely sort of these. I mean, we see gunshots and we're just like, yeah, gunshot, you know, stabbing. You know, you don't really get a sense of it. The only day I really, you know, sort of remember a lot, and I don't work much in the trauma units anymore, but Valentine's Day is quite a terrible day to work in a trauma unit, because I don't know why it is. Valentine's Day doesn't, for some people, seem to be treat each other with respect and love. It seems to be literally beat and rape your partner. Domestic violence is unbelievable on that day, and it's really quite disheartening. But we are definitely desensitized to this. So let's talk about that, because some of the violence we've seen on farms is, you know, I mean, we talk, you know, a shooting, a stabbing, all of these things are quite. Most people think, wow, that's pretty rough. You know, if they hear that happens to someone they know, they think that's hectic. But you know, if you read Ernst's book, if you look at some of the stuff you put up on social media, there really is mad stuff that goes on the farms. Tell us a bit about it.
I always saw it as bad. I've been working for AfriForum for 8 years now, and there's obviously been a lot of times where you kind of, as we said just now, we get desensitized and you kind of get into the rhythm of things. And what changed my way of looking at it, in about, I think it was 2015, I visited a murder scene of Johan Eckart. He's an elderly man in his 70s. He was tortured for 9 hours. When we got to the scene, after the body had been removed, his nail marks were stuck in the carpets, you know, from him being dragged through the house. So 9 hours of torture, you're an elderly man, you can't even walk properly anymore, and you get tortured that way. It changed something in the way that I saw this crime. Not that I previously said, yeah, it's not bad. It just suddenly put a human side to it, where when I saw those marks in the carpet, I realized how desperate this person was to stay alive, and it's quite,
and terrified.
Exactly. It's quite normal. It's shocking to say, but you very often see this. I was speaking to a daughter-in-law of two victims who were murdered on Mother's Day of this year, the 13th of May. And Fani and Colleen Engelbrecht are the two victims that were murdered, also elderly people. The lady had just received a hip replacement. She couldn't walk properly. And the Sunday morning, the husband was going to church, and he locked her inside the house. He threw the keys through the gate for her. If she were to get up, it's quite a struggle. So he threw the keys down the hallway. Long story short, they were attacked. Very badly hurt. I can go through the whole thing, but it's bad. And the point is, once again, got to the scene, and I took a photo of his shoes that they had. You know, it was so precise. It's as though these attackers came in. It was an absolute bloodbath. They took his shoes off, removed the laces to tie him up with, and they perfectly, very neatly packed the shoes next to the table where his dead body would be found later on. And I took a photo of these shoes so nicely, you know, packed away. And it just made me realize that the way these things are committed is completely without any form of humanity behind it. There's no compassion of any sort. It's a complete disregard for something. And the last one that I feel is appropriate to share was, you know, a lot of people think that people that get killed on farms are rich or are very well off. And you know,
with respect, only by people who never been on a farm before.
Exactly.
The sociology professor in Parktown North thinks farmers are rich, but if you actually grew up or lived on a farm, these people are not rich at all.
Peter de Toy also thinks that, I must mention. Sorry, I had to mention his name just to make it clear.
Yeah, useful idiots are useful.
Yeah. So to make it clear, the last one I'd like to tell was a specific lady. I can't actually, it's sad, I can't remember her name. About a year or two ago, she was murdered on a farm close to Hartbeespoort area, northwest. And the thing that stuck with me once again about the repercussions that this leaves is when walked into the scene, her body was lying down the hallway. The suite papers, these people have literally nothing. There's no curtains in the windows. They put cardboard boxes there in winter to warm the house. And she bakes Cook Sisters and cookies to sell next to the road for her children to be able to go to school. That's how she pays school fees. And when I walked through there, the only positive thing that you could see in that house is that she hid sweets for her kids, and that every now and then throughout the house, it'd be little sweet papers that her kids had unwrapped, you know, the sweets there and eaten them. And that picture stuck with me just about something that it was a completely innocent person putting so much in to do something, even though it's just through that sweet that she gives to her kids on a daily basis to at least share something nice with them. And then this horrible atrocity happens and there was nothing to take. There is absolutely nothing to steal. And she was hurt in the way that she was.
Yeah, no, it's a form of dehumanization. It's the first, I can't remember who said it, the first law of something is to dehumanize.
Genocide.
Yeah. We're not arguing that genocide's happening, but it's the first law of ethnic cleansing. Like, yeah. You dehumanize the opponents, yeah, or the victims. And we're not arguing for ethnic cleansing either. We're just saying it's a law. Mm. But, Ian, I mean, let's go right from the beginning. So what do you do at AfriForum? Just give a basic overview and then just give us a view of the process. You get a call, there's been a farm murder. What happens after that?
Okay, so let me start about what we do at AfriForum. About 4 or 5 years ago, we obviously, everyone sees the need for something new, something that can help in crime, so or to combat crime. And so
and
we,
just for context, the policing services that had traditionally been in place to assist with that had been broken up a few years prior. Am I correct?
So to give you background, the commandos were disbanded, which is basically a civilian military service, then it was part of the state. They were disbanded in 2003, and nothing has ever been put back into place to replace that. And not that that was the be-all and end-all. Some of our worst farm attack and murder statistics were during the commando times, but it at least gave the community some form of statutory power to do something about the problem. So what we did, we started forming community safety structures across the country, a lot like neighborhood watches and so on, but the fact that we started building this national network started giving people a little bit more power in doing collective service. So, for example, remember the Uferfall crisis at the beginning of 2018, where the school was being, you know, ransacked by protesters. I liked how you called it earlier the commie way of thinking. You know, there were literally thousands of people protesting at the school for nonsense.
ANC and EFF. To give context, the school refused to take in more pupils
exactly
because they said they didn't have space. And yep. Panyaza Lusufi wanted to force them to change the language policy literally overnight. And he threatened to expel the school principal. And on affidavit, the school went to the high court and prevented him from doing so. And they were called racist for not accepting, I believe it was 5 black pupils.
Yep.
Despite being at capacity and despite not being able to change the language overnight.
And already having several black students in the school. So there was no form of resonance. So the point I'm trying to make is that through that, we were able to, through community safety structures, protect that school for 2 weeks and walked out on the other side with a stronger school, more motivated. Those kids were able to go to school regardless of the threat on the outside. And it was because of a community taking responsibility to safeguard something. And we had, just by the way, great cooperation with the police. But the fact of the matter is the police weren't able to handle it on their own, as we wouldn't have been able to handle it on our own. So we started building community safety structures. We then took it even further. A part of the team is a complete unit of people who can assist in certain parts of an investigation, whether it's to find people, missing people, to find suspects, to assist in the investigation through taking statements, through coaching, not coaching, but let's call it coaching for the sake of this talk, to help people through the court process, to share with that victim, if you are hurt in a farm attack, for example, I can assist you in understanding what's going to happen next. How do you handle this? How do you go to a identification parade at the police station? So all of these types of things have been built in, and through this discussion we can talk more. When it comes to the actual attack or some form of a serious or violent crime that happens, we very often get contacted by the police themselves on ground level. We've got great relationships with a lot of the units. They just simply do not have the resources that they're meant to have. So a lot of them do try very hard. They just do not get the support they need. And we can even talk about that. I can tell you more about the training of the police that's in shambles. But so that's that side. Or we get called by the community. We then have people across the country. We've got 7,500 people that have been trained and that are registered inside our structures to be able to operate in crime scenarios and to assist and also patrol in their communities. And all of this has built a machine in the country that can help to combat crime.
Yeah, because if I understand correctly, what you sort of start with is one neighborhood watch. You know, the simple two guys get together and drive around in their car.
Exactly.
And then you go, well, maybe another car would work. So you have now four guys driving around in their cars. And then you go, but they need to talk to each other. So you give them radios. And then you duplicate that in another place, in another place, another place. And then you go, well, they need to all be talking to someone so that someone can tell them what's happening. So that creates a control room. And so when you have, well, how many do you have now, if you can divulge that type of information?
We've got about 130 across the country.
Communities doing these, yeah. These sort of part of the security yeah. project.
And they are all able to communicate with each other nationally. So every single day, we communicate with all our structures across the country, and it's at the push of a button. So even without cell phones, we've got a national network of radios that works in the same way.
I mean, given the obviously it takes money and effort and volunteerism to build these kinds of things, but given the high levels of crime in the country across everywhere, you know, that's one of the common things said about AfriForum. Oh, why do you care about farm murders? Crime is so high, and we've repeatedly explained on the show why farm murders matter. But you know, this is a model that sounds like it should be something that communities everywhere should try and replicate as far as they can.
Let me tell you a really awesome story, and I think something that can change the crime landscape in South Africa. A few years ago, we had a problem. There was a It's actually a horrible story. There was a serious drug problem in Elliot in the Eastern Cape. And the farmers approached us after two murders that had happened in the region on farms as well. And then there's this massive drug and murder issue in the township areas around the town. And they approached us and said, can we somehow assist them in forming a farm watch and a neighborhood watch? And we said, great, we're coming down. We'll come and visit them. And the night when the first training had to occur for what you are allowed to do and not allowed to do, there's certain training procedures that need to be done. The taxi association called and said, are they allowed to join? And, you know, stereotypically, my first reaction was to laugh. I thought, you know, I'm used to Joburg taxis that just don't give a damn about any form of rule of law or anything like that. And we said, sure, come and join us. And, you know, that night there were more taxi drivers there than farmers. And it ended up being an AfriForum meeting in Khoza. And we spent an awesome evening together.
You racist.
Yeah. You know, that just confirms how racist they are. And, you know, we spent the about 2 weeks training everyone, and it became such a healthy structure that stock theft in the area decreased by over 90% within a month or two. And the challenge that we got a year later was because of corrupt policemen. They started victimizing some of the members of this farm watch. And regardless, the point is just that type of cooperation. When you see farmers in their khaki shirts driving a patrol in a taxi in a township, and then you see the taxis driving with their taxis on the farms, and they all communicate on the same radio network, kind of changes the whole dynamic. And people were shocked. I mean, here's a taxi with an AfriForum signage on the on the door. And those taxi guys are paying members of AfriForum. So, you know, if we start changing the way we look at combating crime, we can definitely change what's happening.
So in terms of that, is that still going on in Elliot?
At the moment it is, but it's slowed down a lot because of the corrupt police side. So we've had a lot of challenges with it. The interesting thing is that story spread and somehow got to Soweto. So we've now been approached by an organization called SA United Against Crime. They actually focus on patrolling in Hillbrow and then also in parts of Soweto, mostly foot patrols, and they've now asked us if we can start training them. So we've already completed a session of training with them in Soweto, and obviously they've received a lot of criticism inside Soweto for doing this. But the interesting part is almost everyone that patrols for them or ex-drug addicts, they're junkies, and they clean now, and they've started this program to get these guys healthy. So we've taken hands with them, and we are trying to see how we can, in Gauteng, get this taxi model rolling again. So obviously it takes time.
Though. Because just explain, well, first of all, so you're creating these structures that should actually be done by the state, if one would. I mean, if you believe the state is competent and godly, which I don't, of course. But what is the reaction that you get if you deal with police officers at crime scenes, or if they're aware of your network? Are you like part of them? Do they try to assist you, or is there a bit of antagonism, or does it depend on the geography or the area?
The geography does play a role, but in the majority of cases with serious and violent crime, the officials that react to those crimes or that work on the investigations are very, very welcoming when it comes to assistance. So on station level, we often have this antagonizing kind of approach, a very political approach as well, sadly enough. But I think you can expect that. But from a more specialized unit side, we do get a lot of support from them. And it's amazing to see how willing they are to even approach us themselves for help. So, you know, for the sake of not exposing them, but there are a lot of crime intelligence units that work through us. We do almost all of their specific tasks when it comes to finding suspects in certain areas where they know we've got strong structures.
Give you instructions.
Yeah.
Because I suspect they have little resources, or they've got no support on their side.
Let's look at their training. So to give you an idea, our wonderful Minister of Police, Bheki Cele, he's this very charismatic guy, but according to me, he's absolutely useless. And Cele was one of the big reasons that the police looks the way it does now. If we go look at the police training when he was the National Commissioner just before the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup, we had a case where Tele, you usually get two remedials if you fail your exam at the police college. He gave some of them four remedials, and even though they failed, he still gave them uniforms. He removed basic modules from tactical training in the police, for example, tactical use and radio communication, tactical use of a shotgun, those types of things. So that's why you then see police officers by mistake shooting and killing their partners, is because they're not trained properly. So it's not that a lot of the officials don't want to help. They don't know how to help you. And that's the danger now. That's why we see an increase in police officials getting killed every year.
He also militarized the police. He also took it back from being a service to a force.
But that also might have an advantage.
It can if it's done properly. If you're using the military aspect for discipline, then I think I would agree with that. But if the military action becomes a way to separate yourself, to give you a sort of step up on the civilians, I am sergeant, I am colonel, do you know who I am type of thing, that's when that kind of becomes dangerous.
You're right. It shouldn't be a status symbol. So it shouldn't be used to the status that they have shouldn't be used to abuse the public. And unfortunately, he started creating that impression. So he started saying shoot to kill, which was good for the morale in the police, because a lot of officials started feeling, wow, I'm actually getting supported by a national commissioner. But now you've got guys that don't have the training, they start shooting the wrong people and they start acting in the wrong way, and it's got this chain reaction of bad things happening. The police currently only have one clinical psychologist left in the entire police service in the country.
For 150 policemen.
Exactly.
Police officers,
So it's really it's tragic what's left of the basic human resource support that you need to give to your people. Regarding training, it's not good. There's according to me, it's not very positive. If we look at the way they're being trained, it's definitely not the same quality than it even was about 5 or 10 years ago, and that standard is decreasing.
And just the volition of the police generally that you speak to, I mean, are they, how can I explain it? It's difficult because on the one hand, I understand they are despondent, they have no resources, they are not well trained. On the other, is there practically parasites? They become policemen and they just take the salary and just don't care. Obviously, there's a spectrum.
A lot. And that comes from the Tele Time, because you put people in uniforms just for the sake of having enough officials during the Soccer World Cup. So it just became this machine of producing blue uniforms. And now it's become a thing where people just go and they get a salary at the end of each month. They get a, you know, they get covered by medical aid and so on. But they don't actually work for it. There's no calling for them to be involved with the police. And obviously, you know, to be an effective police official, you need to see the calling in doing that job.
Oh, yes, because... Yeah, not to put a too light thing on it, but at the end of the day, you have to put yourself in danger. Or that's what being, you know, policemen, firefighters,
anyone in public service, like a teacher, it's a calling. You know that pay is not great, but you have this wish.
You're
to,
there to serve
educate
the public.
Yeah. Educate people.
Well, yeah, and what you do ultimately. You know, if all of you do it together properly, so take a teacher. Every teacher has that kind of attitude towards teaching, you raise an entire generation, and the success of an entire country can depend on you as a teacher. And so, I mean, policing is no different. You know, the safety of an entire country depends on you if you do your job properly or not. But I mean, from what you're saying, it sounds as if, you know, when police are being called to whatever it happens to be, I mean, I would imagine a lot of them justifiably are crapping themselves because they're driving to scene of a shooting, say, in progress, and they're thinking to myself, I don't know what to do.
Yep. There's a report that we released with the Institute for Race Relations about a year or two ago. Dr. Franz Cronier and I actually released the report together. The specific report is called Winning the War on Crime. And that report actually has evidence in it from police in the Western Cape that you're a shooting going on, a gang shooting usually, going on, for example, in the Cape Flats or Mitchell's Plain area, and they hear this happening and they actually would say in front of the researcher or one of the journalists that worked on the report, listen, we're going to wait 5 or 10 minutes just for the shooting to pass before we react. So it's, and it, these aren't bad guys. These are guys that want to help, but they are scared of putting themselves in danger. They are scared that the state will throw them under the bus if they do act and they end up winning the fight, because there's this false sense, and it's kind of this, sorry to say it, but this Huffington Post kind of approach where as soon as a police official acts within the legal framework to protect other people, the criminal is suddenly the victim. You know, and there's this type of mentality that's grown in the police where they are scared to act because they don't get the support that they need.
I think that's been a long time coming. I want to talk about media just now, but I think, you know, I even can remember pretty much 20 years back when the minute, exactly as you're describing, the minute the perpetrator becomes a victim somehow, the minute they were shot by police or the police arrested them, but the takedown was a little bit hard or whatever, the story doesn't become about the crime that they were being taken down for, which... Yes, it's alleged and innocent until proven guilty, but they were literally disarmed from pointing a gun at someone. So something was going on. The story becomes about them, and then the story becomes about them as a victim. And I think we hit sort of peak this kind of feeling about the police doing their job and the crossover between police brutality with Marikana, because there is no... sort of middle ground discussion on Marikana at all. I mean, I'm not denying that people were likely murdered by police at Marikana and pretty much execution style killed. I think there's good forensic evidence for that. But I also remember seeing video on EWN's website or 702, whatever it was at the time, which I think has since been removed, but of people running at police with pangas, and it was like, you know, tens of men. So the discussion, we can't have this discussion anymore. And I think whatever the police do with regards, if they wield any violence, and we need to remember that according to the law, the police are meant to have a monopoly on violence. That's kind of, the state gets to have that, and then they delegate that to the police.
Exactly.
And but anytime they use violence, they're seen to be wrong. Mm. And
you know, it's come to a point. About a month ago, I spent time in the Western Cape in one of the very bad gang-ridden areas, and I was speaking to a senior police official that's involved with combating gang violence. And we were having coffee. We every few times a year we meet and just chat a little bit. And what he said to me, it's easier for him to now negotiate a shooting standstill between the gangs than what it is to act against them, because he doesn't have the resources for it. So the fact is just that, you know, the criminals have the overhand. They're becoming career criminals in what they do. They know that the prosecuting authority don't have the capacity or even the political will to stop them.
Not just criminals, they criminal politicians as well.
Well, exactly.
They've worked out the politics of the scenario.
Exactly.
So back to the safety network. So on the ground, I mean, do you have people that are armed with, I don't know, semi-automatic pistols and rifles? Do you have, what sort of resources do these people have? And what duties or, you know, what functions do they actually do as part of this network?
Well, let's say the basic function is that it's very important that we always say they need to dominate the area. So by saying that, they need to be very people need to be able to see them. So they need to be very visible. They need to be able to know that there is a strong community safety structure in the area. So we focus a lot on visibility, lights, patrols in the area, whether it's foot patrols or vehicles, regardless, that people need to know that they are there. We immediately then see a decrease in crime. We also then have systems that can, through algorithms with crimes as they are reported locally, we can start predicting in certain localities where the next crime might happen. And so we adapt our patrols according to that in some areas, and for that reason we start pushing crime out of complete regions. A lot of them are armed, but they've got no extra rights when it comes to being armed. It's in their private capacity. We obviously have a lot of legal requirements that they need to fit into, because obviously it's not only a risk to them, but also to AfriForum.
Sure.
So we need to make sure that's in place, and we focus a lot on the legalities when it comes to that.
So are these private citizens who just tap into the system as independent? It's, for lack of a better word, independent contractors. Like, they're not employed. You don't employ
them.
They
don't get paid. These are volunteers that say, I'm taking ownership for the problem in my community. But this has a major risk, and this isn't to scare people off, but one of my guys was shot with an AK 6 weeks ago, and he actually got released from hospital today. He was in Mill Park for 6 weeks.
The right place to be.
Exactly. It's the perfect hospital, and just... Yep. By the way, kudos to the hospital. They are incredible.
They saved my life on one occasion.
So exactly. So he came out with one kidney less, half of his liver removed, a lot of other issues that happened. The fact is he put himself at risk through reacting to a robbery, and he got shot. And so that is the risk. But I can tell you that where these neighborhood watches and farm watches that form part of our national network operate, they do have a lot of success. In the last 12 months, we've had more than 140 murder arrests that have been made through these structures. Mm. And if you think those are community structures doing this, it just shows you it can be effective.
And let's just talk to deterrent as well, because I've spoken about it before on the show. I have had some experience in security, and deterrent is a really important aspect of things. It's not necessarily, you're not going out there to patrol to try shoot anyone or try get into a fight. In fact, that's the last thing you want to actually end up happening. What you're trying to do is you're trying to show criminals that this area has people who are aware. Ideally, you actually don't want the criminals to know whether the people are armed and how well armed, etc. they are. And so I'd rather not take my chances. Let me go somewhere else where the risk is less. This is seen worldwide across how places are policed, across terrorists moving, originally choosing one site and then seeing, oh, there's security there. And actually it turned out not to be. It was just some guy standing on the curb and they moved to another site. So these kinds of things happen all over the place.
Yes, prevention's better than cure.
Sure. And do you see that in your stats?
For sure. We had a case now actually in the Western Cape in this town. It's a small town. It's in a rural area. We've had more than a 70% decrease in crime in the CBD since this neighborhood watch has dominated the area. So it works. The fact is just we need to increase this on a larger urban scale and have more people push information into a system where it can be changed or adapted into intelligence that we can then use to act proactively.
Have you ever taken this sort of system to the government and said, you know, we want to help solve issues with you?
Oh, several times. In fact, one of the systems that we use, one of the guys who developed it has even offered it for free to not only the Hawks, but also to the South African Police Service, and nothing's come from it. So, the fact is our government makes money out of crime because the more security there is, the more tax is paid on businesses.
Employment, it drives employment.
It drives employment. More than 600,000 people are employed by the private security industry in South Africa. Those are just the legal security entities. There are a lot of illegal ones. So government's making money out of it. Why would they stop it? They are direct. Creating income for themselves when it comes to crime.
Well, I mean, okay, that's a bit of a...
It's a cynical way of looking at it.
It's very cynical. I mean, yeah. I mean, even cynical for me, Jonathan.
Well, then it takes a lot.
It's one way of looking at it, though. I mean,
I just think, you know, Hanlon's razor.
Well, also, I think the flip side of that is obviously if they tried to solve the problem, then we would have a lot better, you know, because they lose money as well every time someone gets shot or stabbed or raped or whatever happens to them and they've got to go to a public hospital.
But I don't think it's an economic argument.
No, it's not an economic argument. I'm just saying make an economic argument out of it.
I just think for them it's easy. They just let the private sector do what they need to do. They try to regulate as much as possible. When the crime goes down, they take the credit despite not doing anything. If the crime goes up, oh well. We'll do better. There's no skin in the game for them either way.
Look, we can make it an economic argument all we like. The fact is, we need to go back to the human side of it. And absolutely. If we do that, we realize what the damage is. And what's important about this, if you go look at, for example, cash in transit heists in the country, every time before an election, the year before, there's a massive hike in cash in transit heists.
Ooh,
and this
conspiracy.
This isn't. That's the awesome part. It really does happen that way.
Of course, it does happen.
There's a clear trend that this occurs. So we can debate all we like. The point is there are so many criminal elements inside government at the moment that it definitely has gain on a personal note for those individuals who are involved. You can see that by the cops that were fired now and that Tele announced yesterday. You know, more than 1,200 cops have been fired because of murder, rape, and so forth. If that's just the little bit that they're announcing, can you imagine how big the problem really is?
Well, I mean, let's
just
talk about Colonel Prinsloo, who sold 1,200 weapons on the Cape Flats to gangsters, and those weapons killed over 1,000 people, I believe.
Yep. Exactly.
And then you had the chap at Lutuli House who was arrested for being a cash in transit kingpin. Since that arrest, Jonathan, have you heard of cash in transit heists?
It's funny,
the past two months.
It's weird.
It is weird, isn't it?
Soon as they connected it to Lutuli House,
it stopped.
It's just a conspiracy.
It's quite amazing. I'm just waiting for Peter Detoy to give context.
So I want to talk about that because, you know, according to the media, Afri Forum cops a lot of flack in the media for every reason they can find. Some of it valid criticism, I think, and some of it...
I'm still looking for that valid criticism, to be fair.
Well, I think the problem is as it's become more insane over the past sort of year and a half, you'll battle to find valid criticism.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we can all take some criticism and we can all things we might do or say that we could have done better. I mean, even Ernst on the show said, look, he went with a certain strategy to Parliament.
Sure.
If you felt he was too aggressive, well, he wanted to be too aggressive, but he understood how that might have been seen by some people. So The media doesn't really give you any leeway. They think that basically you're a racist organization. They think that you only help white communities. So that's their justification for that accusation. They feel that, I don't know, you're nationalistic, I suppose. You dream of the old apartheid days. That obviously farm murders is not that big a problem. That's been repeatedly said. Our own president, in context, said that no farmers have been killed. So give me your feeling. You know, you're sitting there daily. You're doing a job. You're actually seeing people get murdered. You know, my first introduction to you was through Twitter, through seeing, you know, you tweet farm attack, and sometimes it comes with graphic images and all that type of stuff. And so you're seeing this on a daily basis. You're seeing people actually get murdered, children being raped and tortured and then killed. All of the stuff going on, you're seeing what you do on the ground, all the stuff you've described, and then you're reading the newspapers and sort of clickbait websites like News24. And, you know, what do you think?
First of all, I really believe that the majority of the journalists who accuse us of these things know it's not true. I think it just doesn't suit their personal agenda when it comes to politics. And they like to drive this, you know, this little, let's rather call it ANC rhetoric, for the sake of not being rude. They try to drive this agenda by criticizing us because it doesn't fit into their little stereotypical framework that they would like to blame us on. That article that we saw of, what's it, Christy van der Veste is in,
something like that,
on News 24 today, was a perfect example of this, where this person states that we are generally ignored by people. We are the biggest civil rights organization in the Southern Hemisphere, and not mentioning in Africa. So, you know, this speaks for itself. We are not just some, you know, little side figure organization.
You're not the white BLF.
Exactly. It's as simple as that. And when it comes to the crimes themselves, I always invite these journalists, like a Pieter de Tooy, Adrian Basson, I can go through the Max de Pryor. I would like to tell them, come with me just for a week, okay? If you've got the stomach, and this isn't to gloat about it, it's simply to say this takes an emotional toll on a lot of people, including us. And if you've got the stomach to come and see this for a week, then you're allowed to comment on it. But don't make comments and hide behind a computer screen, sit in your aircon office because it's comfortable, and you would like to comment about something you know nothing about. And this counts for, in fact, for any form of violent crime. A lot of people say to us, why do you only look at farm murders? Well, we've got a specific interest. We can talk about that if you like. But the fact is, there's a specific part of us that focuses on this unique crime. The point is just, people can't make sweeping statements about the way we combat it or the way that we share these stories if they know nothing about it. And at the moment, they're trying to trying to fit their little political agenda into this argument, and that's how they try and disregard AfriForum. The interesting part is, every time they do this, they're actually doing us a favor. We grow even more the more they make these types of statements.
Ian, don't tell them. You need them.
they won't stop. They like their own voices every time too much.
You must say, every time they do an opinion piece, you lose 10,000 members. It's very important that they keep doing them, and the inverse happens.
It's funny, though. They can't help themselves. They have to Streisand. This is actually a pathology of the left, is that they tend to Streisand effect everything in the last 10 years. You know, instead of just ignoring the stuff that irritates them, and then it will obviously, sometimes it'll go away. Donald Trump is the best example of this in recent history.
I mean, Hillary Clinton, you know, made the biggest faux pas ever. She called his supporters deplorables.
No, but before that.
And then her slogan was Love Trump Hates. What?
Love Trump Hates.
So you have your enemy, your opponent's name in your own slogan.
But not even that.
Pathetic.
You know, a guy enters an election race where there's 16 other guys running. He enters, I think, second or third last.
And a lady.
Yes, and Carly Fiorina.
That one.
And he enters the race, one of the last guys to enter the race. And, you know, nobody gave him a chance. And truth be told, he wouldn't have had a chance. But people have done various sort of studies and gone back and looked at all the media coverage. And there's arguments that he got up to $1 billion in free media coverage that other candidates didn't get. And this happens all the time. So the Streisand effect happens a little bit, obviously, to a lesser extent with you guys. Happens to us as well. But I think we would like, more than the Streisand effect, we would like to be properly represented. You know, it's not about not, it's not about whether you disagree or agree with us. That's fine. Disagree.
Just be objective. That's the point.
Or a little bit honest.
Just honest. You know, just everyone should be disliked for what it actually does and stand for. Mm. Not these myths that are created about you. Exactly. It's the same thing we say to the DA. Just be honest about who you are. And if people don't like you, tell them not to vote for you. Like, yeah. It is that simple. And everyone has taken that stance. You're quite actually like a stubborn organization.
in a good way.
Yeah, in a very good way. Like, we're very stubborn on this show. Where does that come from? Like, what? How do you keep going the course despite all these, you know, attacks on you?
Well, I think we realize how important it is to have a strong identity. I think that's where the DA sometimes, you know, gets a bit of criticism, is that people don't always know where they stand. What really is your identity? And we're proud of the organization that we are. We support the fact that you need to have a strong identity. And if you are able to maintain that, we don't really see you failing. The fact is, just, it shouldn't be at the cost of someone else. So if someone else has a legitimate cause, regardless whether it's a cultural organization, if it's something to do with music, for example, it doesn't matter. If they've got a legitimate cause that doesn't break the law and that doesn't, you know, move on to an extremist type of view, then they have a reasonable reason to be there. And we need to make sure that our existence isn't at the cost of other people.
Yeah, I mean, the only problem with AfriForum is that you're too centrist.
Yo, Ramon, you know, you always got to take it that next level, eh? All right, well, just finally, from my side.
We've got plenty of time.
No, we do have plenty of time, but in terms of things that I really wanted to discuss with you, just a little bit on the personal, because before we started recording, you know, you kind of, and even Ramon was getting into a little bit of this, we were mentioning the sort of personal attacks, because your organization has become, as you say, it's with the largest civil rights group in on the continent. Certainly in terms of media, I think you were very large before this latest flurry of media coverage. Let's go sort of prior to anyone going to America and all that kind of stuff. You were a big organization, but now you're sort of thrust into the main spotlight. You're the enemy, you know. There's Cyril and there's AfriForum. And that's kind of the dichotomy. Certainly 2 weeks ago, that was the dichotomy. What kind of blowback are you guys getting in personally from all of this?
It hasn't changed much. They haven't really been able to, with all this, you know, what feels like extra criticism, they haven't really been able to threaten us more than usual. It's just the usual carrying on.
And usual death threats.
We often see on Google Maps, our office has a few, you know, Photoshop pictures on it now where we're being told that it'll be burnt and so on. But I love going to the office, and I've never felt threatened there. Mm. So it hasn't really changed. I think it's also important to know that the way you grow and when you grow, you are going to receive the, you know, more criticism as you would more compliments. So as long as we keep, you know, we keep focused on our members, and that we support them, and that we act on, you know, with the moral high ground in what we do, I don't see there being a problem. Obviously, some of us, me included, we do personally also receive criticism and threats sometimes. But we're doing the right thing, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. And the threats haven't worked very well. So
why is it? Why do you think that there hasn't been, like, you know, your offices haven't been barricaded, or people have been, you know, outside it protesting something? Because my theory is, these, like the EFF and the mobs that they employ, and the ANC mobs, they prey on weakness. So they go to, you know, the Adam Katsavelos's, you know, business, and the business falls over, and they say, yes, we agree to everything, and it closes down, and they lose all the jobs and everything. AfriForum is a very strong brand, a very strong organization, and I think if people had to try barricade it or mob it, they would actually come up against people who are willing to fight them on their own terms. Not in a physical sense, but I'm talking about in a metaphorical, ideological sense. Like, you care deeply about what you do, and you will destroy anyone who tries to destroy that.
Well, it's quite simple. The ANC, the EFF, we can take it as far as BLF if you like, but I don't think they're even worth mentioning. All of these organizations function on a scavenger type of way, so you can kind of see them as the hyenas when it comes to, and I'll explain it to you.
But it's a bit racist. I know we don't like to compare.
I'm sorry, the H word is acceptable still.
Hyena.
They are hyenas. Fine. Right. That we're allowed.
That's okay. The only part of the jungle I should mention, and I don't work for H&M, so I'm lucky. let me explain to you when it comes to them, I really think it comes to the balance of forces idea. So as soon as they see they're really going to get retaliated to, or that there's something that is being defended properly, they usually fall back. And this is another reason why they get away with so much when it comes to the police and unrest in public, is because the police, as you said earlier, are scared of Americana, and they know how far they can push the police. A lot of these guys are experts at the way they push unrest in civil unrest in specific regions, and I think they know that from AfriForum side we are a disciplined organization, and we will look after whatever is ours.
Yeah, because I mean, and that's the point. I mean, and you're the only one on if I may say, that side of the center right spectrum or classic liberal spectrum that actually has a bit of gumption and a bit of force that stands behind you.
I think there's a second aspect to it. I mean, yeah. you might still see something like the EFF at some point trying to make something of this, but my sense is that many people in South African society look at an organization like AfriForum and probably think to themselves, sure, be nice if a community like mine had an organization like that. Or they look at it and go, yeah, they're not doing anything wrong. They have members. I mean, I look at it and go, well, okay, they have members who pay them. Their members want them to do certain things. They're doing those things that their members want them to do. Otherwise, they wouldn't A, hang on to those members, and B, have relatively phenomenal growth. And so, you know, I think people tend to resonate with the freedom of association.
Yeah, no, but I'm not talking about ordinary South Africans. I think ordinary South Africans don't care about you, with due respect. Like, another organization exactly. that has whatever. Yeah. No one cares. But it's that intransigent minority idea that we keep going on about. The EFF do it very well. The ANC don't do it too well, but they're such a monolith. It's difficult to do well. And AfriForum does it really well. DA doesn't. I don't know of any other group that does it as well as you and the EFF. You have a core set of ideals that you're willing to fight for. But for some reason, like, you never clash. And that's why I'm wondering why they don't try to pick on you. Because if they destroy you, it's a massive coup.
Can I tell you an interesting story about the EFF? I don't know if you remember, with Fees Must Fall, there was a stage when they said Afrikaans must fall, at Tuck specifically, at the University of Pretoria. Yep. And during that time, there was a face-off between a whole lot of Afrikaans students. A lot of them were AfriForum youth members. They were about 35, maybe 40, and the EFF were about 350 or 400. The EFF lost that day, and they lost quite badly. In fact, they tried to regroup the next day, and only 7 people showed up. And I believe it's the first time in the history of the EFF where they were showed down by civilians, and they couldn't understand how a small group of people were able to look them in the eye, not be scared of them, where they couldn't intimidate them. And these guys started singing to them with a smile on their face, And they had to face a few bricks and stones and rocks and glass bottles that came flying over. And a lot of the guys did get hurt. They ended up having to go to get stitches and so on. But the EFF couldn't understand this. And the point is just, we do not have to live in fear in the country of this, you know, supposed third force EFF that's going to take over. They are not the majority. They are a very small group still. They might look big when they do big protests and Malema speaks and shoots his gun into the air and so on. The fact is just they are not this majority group. They are still a small, noisy majority in the country. The average South African is a balanced human being. They are good people.
Yeah, they're centrist. And that's the thing, because I think the EFF are classic bullies.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Scavengers.
And a lot of or scavengers. That's actually a better term. I wish you call them that. Economic freedom scavengers.
You can say vulture.
No, vultures. No, they're wonderful creatures.
South Africa's not dead yet, so they can't carry the corpse. Hyenas still kill things. But they are the quintessential bullies in essence. And we know with bullies it takes a lot of guts and sometimes you're scared. But if you stand up to them, bullies back down because they're just not used to it. They're used to people rolling over and giving them what they want. And I think a lot of political parties, the so-called liberation types, like the EFF and the ANC, will roll over once people just point that the emperor has no clothes. But people are very fearful to point that out.
Well, not only that, you know, you talk about the size of them. If they have a march and there's 5,000 people, that looks impressive. It really does. You know, 5,000 people, and it doesn't matter who does it. The DA, I think, had a march last year, the year before. It was the Stop Zuma march or whatever it was, and they had something like that, and it looked really impressive. You know, a street in Cape Town, the right camera angle, and a sea of blue. But the reality is that 0.01% of the entire population, it's a nothing. It's a drop in the ocean. You can make the argument, as media often does, that, oh, they managed to get that many people to mobilize, you know. So, yes, while it's only this small amount of people in the overall population, they actually got them to be in one place at one time. Yeah, okay. I mean, you can make that argument, but then music festivals do that all the time, and exactly. And they have people throwing money at them on top of it. Mm. It's absolutely what we've been mentioning about, you know, the tyranny of the minority. And the loud minority, and unfortunately helped along by useful idiots in the media who are selling a lie of what these people are, who they overall represent, and how big their voice actually is. Because once again, 5,000 people is 0.01% of the population.
And Malema thrives off the misinformed and lazy journalism that's out there. He thrives on that type of sensationalist look at things. He thrives on the fact that, for example, an AfriForum might get criticism about something that we never even said. So he immediately jumps on that, and that's where the scavenger part once again comes in.
Right.
He's a bully. So he uses it, and he's clever. People don't realize the way he approaches these things, and that's where I say, I think a lot of people wouldn't believe that it would come out of an AfriForum staff member's mouth, but hats off to Malema in the way that he is able to play this game.
Yeah, I mean, Gareth Van Onselen wrote a great piece in Business Live or Business Day, whatever you call it, this week about him being the greatest political leader in South Africa today. And it's absolutely correct. Yeah. A lot of people think he's like some sort of buffoon from the Northwest. And he's really not. He's very clever. He just has the completely wrong politics. I think if he was a type of reformist capitalist, he would be extremely popular.
But you see, the problem is, so I don't think he's that clever. I think clever comes in different sort of guises. And I think people who know how to game systems are not necessarily clever. So, you know, Malema's learned, for example, the more crazy a thing he says, the more likely he is to be picked up by a whole bunch of newspapers. And if he's then picked up by a whole bunch of newspapers, then he can control the narrative for a period of time, depending on how nuts the thing he said is. And if it gets even worse than that, and he's reported to the Human Rights Commission or something, that's even better, because now he can play the victim as that. And he's learned how to game whatever the system happens, you know, whether it's the government system, whether it's how to play the ANC at their own game. I think that's the funniest thing about all of this. So we've said he wants to go back to the ANC regardless. But the reality is even if he doesn't, he's a guy who grew up in the ANC, who knows how every one of their structures works. He knows who gets an SMS first when the NEC makes a decision. He knows who the president talks to first when he wants to change a policy. He knows all of this stuff. At one point, the media were being open about this. They were saying, Julius is the best leaker.
Yeah, just follow him on Twitter.
He will tell you everything the ANC is doing. Mm. And if you speak to journalists privately, they'll tell you straight, you know, if you want to know the inner workings or what's happening behind the scenes, he's the guy to talk to.
But he's not just clever in that way. For example, the unofficial so-called coalitions that he's in at the moment, it's a partnership, no official coalition agreement, no official agreement on policies. Mm. And he controls them in a way that he controls them as long as they are useful. He decided Trollope wasn't useful to show a bit of might to the DA that he can take them out. He took Trollope out. After the sixth time, it wasn't like very successful, but he got it. He's struggling with Solims among there. So by not having an official coalition, A, they're not responsible for any screw-up those municipalities do.
They can always claim deniability.
And number two, they can just change it if they feel like it. It's a very powerful position, and we tend to underestimate the strategy involved. Long-term strategy is possibly 2019, he collapses all coalitions, votes with the ANC, and gets to be the kingmaker within ANC structures at the very high level. And that has been the plan since 2013 when he started the EFF. Who knows? Who knows how long his game is? They say Syrah is a long game. I don't think he knows what he's doing tomorrow. Julius is far more strategic. And if you think he's an idiot or a buffoon or a crazy racist, he might be all those things. But you're disarming yourself if you think someone is just crazy, because they might not
be. You know what I believe? I truly believe that the things that he says need to be taken seriously. I think a lot of people laugh it off. And there's something that Winston Churchill said about Hitler. This isn't exactly, you know, regardless whether you like Malema or not, just for example's sake, Winston Churchill said that, you know, you need to believe what Hitler's saying. And a lot of the people before Churchill's time said, no, we'll go and talk to him. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
The first time I was in Lethule House, me personally, a few years ago about farm murders, Malema was still the leader of the Youth League. He said that if we ever put our feet there again, he'll shoot us from the seventh floor. So he hasn't shot at us. He shot into the air in the Eastern Cape. But the fact of the matter is, the things that he has said up to now has become true, quite a few of them. The way that he's grown, the utterances that we hear, even at farm attacks. Guys, it's a reality. The things that victims tell us in their statements is quite clear. And I'm not, I don't want to go into the conspiracy of who orchestrates and whatever. That's a discussion on its own. The point is just, he does have a massive influence on what's happening on ground level. The danger I believe we have before the next election is that the ANC with the EFF are going to make a lot of places ungovernable. They're going to make a massive use of civil unrest. The frustration in the country is massive. We see Ennerdale again today, what's happened there, the shutdowns across the rest of certain areas about drugs and so on. I believe that they're going to abuse that next year, and that poses a danger to the more kind of central view on things.
Well, it also pushes the populace perhaps to, you know, long term, you have enough of that. You might want a guy like Julius, because a guy like Julius, if he pivots to, I'm the guy you should elect because I will put up with none of this shit, and I will bring in the military, and I will, you know, have a heavy hand with the police.
The law and order candidates.
Yeah, exactly. Once you've terrorized the population, you know, sort of Bane from Dark Knight, you terrorize the population, and then you show them that you can bring, you know, justice and law and order to them. So I think that's certainly making things ungovernable where they don't govern is a part of it, but also using that to manipulate the electorate is also an interesting sort of theory.
Yeah, no doubt. So, I mean, long term, I mean, what do you see as Afrifarm's role if we assume that state degradation will continue, if we assume that institutions will be hollowed out? I mean, do you foresee a parallel state, so to speak, or a private state in where that you can not every foreign voluntarily wants to be the government, so to speak, but where you can control certain things that prevents your members or people in communities from feeling that state degradation at a local level.
Well, I believe that I don't even know if we would call it a state maybe later or even now, but what I do believe is that in certain spheres of service that needs to be delivered by government, we would try and empower communities to do that. So in certain parts of the northern areas in KwaZulu-Natal, we're already in a position where all refuse removal is done by AfriForum community members, where they've built a system where they can do recycling in order to get money back, in order to fix potholes in the area, in order for them to make sure that the bins are fixed on the high street in the town. So, you know, there's this chain reaction. And this is a small example. It's not common, but that's the way we're looking at it, that you put the power back into the hands of the community, not in a communist type of sense, where we are really trying to say that the community takes responsibility and that we can't just wait for government to do things. And that's the biggest thing. A lot of people believe, and they always say that you know, we look back at a previous government and so on. And I wasn't even alive during that time in the South African history. But what I must say is that I think the worst thing that happened in the previous regime is that people became dependent on government. So as soon as something goes wrong, they immediately point a finger at government instead of taking responsibility themselves. And that's the type of responsibility we're trying to get back into communities, where people say, but I'm going to take ownership of the problem.
Yeah, Piet Leroux told us this, the head of Soccer Liga, formerly AfriSoccer. He said, you know, apartheid was not terribly helpful to Afrikaners because it made them state dependent, exactly. Essentially, because Afrikaners came through hundreds of years by self-determination, so to speak. And then once they got into power, they became lazy and corrupted.
Yeah.
And now AfriForum is sort of a reaction to that, in a way, whereby you create emergent order through private institutions, and you and people fund it themselves, so that you do, you know, state proof yourself, yeah, from, yeah, state predation.
How do you plow back into the community? And that's exactly it. We need to get away from a grant mentality, because the country lives on grants, a large part of the country, and we simply cannot afford. It's not sustainable. It will never be sustainable. We have to make sure that
even if it were sustainable, it's not a way to live, because those grants they don't really pay for much. So. Yeah. Even if you could continue paying it forever more, you had a never ending tax base, or yeah, just you won the lottery every week, you, yeah, know, the South African government entered the British lottery or something and they kept winning. It wouldn't matter, because the amount that those grants gives people no actual ability,
you're right,
to live a decent life.
Yeah. I had a discussion with a veteran journalist from the BBC, who now works for ABC in Australia, and we had a blog about 2 weeks ago. They were in South Africa, her and her husband, and we were having dinner and we were discussing exactly this, the grant mentality. And this, she told me that in Australia, they've got such a big problem under the Aborigine community, that there are third, even fourth generations that haven't worked. So they have never been put into a working mentality, that I need to work for whatever I get at the end of a month in order for me to have a sustainable future. The grants are so good that it makes sense for them rather not to work and just to sit around. And that's when all the other social problems start moving in, and it just creates an unhealthy society.
Same as in America, well, and Australia. It's that, you know, it's the unintended consequence of white guilt, historical guilt. I mean, the Aborigines were, I would not hesitate to say that was a genocide. A genocide by,
yeah, it's
people.
Terrible. No, it's
and also,
terrible.
But also the illnesses that spread. I mean, more were killed by illness, same as Native American Indians. Yeah. But the Native American Indians who live on reservations now, given to them by the state, this is your homeland, or it was, we took it away from you. They have the highest drug dependency rate in the entire country, much more than what we suspect might be Hispanic communities. No, the Native Americans, same as in Australia. So that's the unintended consequences of guilt. We're very sorry about what our ancestors did.
So let's feed the problem.
So we're going to, exactly, we're just going to carry on. And I think that might be a reason why I saw the incident race relations released issues, election issues, and drugs is number two after jobs. It's never been that high.
It's even before crime.
Exactly, and that's never been that high ever. And I believe it's a consequence.
Well,
of people just being unemployed and having whatever little money they can have just to feel a sensation, to feel something.
While I'm not against court's ruling, the constitutional court's ruling on marijuana, although I am against the way they came to it, because I don't think it should be a privacy ruling. I just think they should change the bloody law, which is what the parliament is meant to do.
Well, the facts before them was on privacy. So they
Those things are always stupid. It's the same as Roe versus Wade. Roe versus Wade in America, the abortion law was based on a privacy ruling. And that's why it's going to get overturned at some point in the future, because at some point in the future, that ruling, which was bullshit, wasn't based on abortion. It was based on what you're allowed to do with your body in private. And so that's why it's likely to be overturned. It's not. It wasn't a moral ruling. Whichever side of this argument you sit on, you should want a ruling based on the actual thing, not based on a loophole to get there. So we've got a loophole to get to marijuana legality in this country, instead of because politicians are too scared, chicken shit, to say we're going to make a law. Because that's their job. It's not the job of the courts to make laws or change laws. This is like a loophole that lawyers use because politicians become useless and aren't willing to sit in parliament and go, we're going to make a bill. We're going to make a bill, turn it into an act. And in South Africa, the bill should be, we're going to change the law where it says that marijuana is illegal, and we're going to make a law that says it's now legal. But I think, and as I say, I'm fine with it being legal, but I don't think a lot of the country is. I also think that one of the problems we have is we've got these kinds of things which are celebrated, drugs being, someone who lives in a community where drugs are a scourge on the community. And that's not because they're legal or illegal, but they won't view it like that. They're not going to go, now they're legal, so it won't be as much of a problem. Or it was because they were illegal that they're a problem in my community. Because chances are that community has, drugs have, in a lot of these communities, have taken hold. And so making them legal or illegal doesn't change much. It might change something over many years. And I think that people look at that, they see that change, they don't see simple stuff like stupid labor laws change, or they don't see politicians who break the law going to jail. They don't see any of that kind of stuff happening, and that's why I'm not surprised to see that on the IRR's radar. I think once again we underestimate the conservatism of the South African population. I don't always agree with that conservatism and their views on certain social issues, but I think you ignore that at your peril.
Well, it's a bit like what Valdemar Pelser said, the editor of Report. He says, Report has a readership. Sometimes he disagrees with that readership, but you have to cater to it. It may be more conservative than you as editor. It may be more liberal than you as editor. It doesn't really matter. You have to cater to the market at the end of the day. And that's what... And I think that's what AfriForum does quite well. You cater to your market, which I assume, if I'm honest with you, I assume is middle-class Afrikaners. Do you have any association with what we would call black groups, for lack of a better word? Do you try to work with other organizations that are similar to you but serve maybe a different demographic or a different
market? Well, I think market? Some of them aren't even similar. I just believe that they might have one or two goals that we agree on. We might not agree on everything, but as I mentioned earlier, SA United Against Crime in Soweto is a completely black organization. There is not one white face, though we do community planning together, strategic sessions when it comes to them combating crime in their areas, and even us, and we support each other through doing that. So the point is, from our side, we look for partnerships. We speak with as many people as possible. I think a lot of people thought Kali Creel is approaching serious politics when they saw him and Monsieur Lakota, Terra doing a press conference together.
Or the Zulu King. He went to his birthday party. King.
So the good thing about that is it keeps people wondering. But regardless, if we can form an alliance where we can work together for a common goal, not one at the cost of another, I believe it's a healthy thing to do.
You must follow the age-old historical precedence of the Boere and the Zulus working together against a common enemy.
Well, but this is the problem. with society at the moment is people believe that you are one thing or you think one thing, therefore you think all the other things that are related to that, and then anyone else who thinks the opposite thing cannot possibly relate to you. The best example I can think of at the moment is Kanye West, who I don't think is, we've discussed him on the show before, I don't think he's a genius by any sense, but occasionally...
He's a musical genius.
Fine, I agree with that. But occasionally he...
Keep telling yourself
he,
that.
He has... Occasionally he says stupid, completely stupid things that you're like, are you like what are you thinking?
Yeah, right?
And occasionally he says intelligent things. I mean, this past week he turned around and said he thinks Donald Trump and Colin Kaepernick should get together and they should have a discussion. I agree. I do not think for one second that Colin Kaepernick is going to convince Donald Trump of much, and I don't think that Donald Trump will convince Colin Kaepernick of anything. But I do think that it's important they sit down and have a discussion. I don't think that because they have differing views, they can't sit at a table and maybe say they both like Coke or whatever it is. And this is the problem we have at the moment. We are not allowed to... you know, if I sit across from you now, in a year's time when they write a hit piece on me for whatever I do at the time, they'll say, and Jonathan is well known to have fraternized with far right groups like AfriForum. Here's a picture of him with Ian, and here's a picture of him with Ernst. And because if I've sat across from you or I've taken a photograph with you, it must mean I agree with everything, Ian, that you think in life. And it must mean you agree with everything that I do in life. Mm. And of course, this guilt by association is just the best thing ever, because we can dispense with entire groups of people if you're all guilty based on your sort of 6 degrees of separation.
Well, that's what the citizen, sorry to interrupt. That's what the citizen did to Ernst Rutz and Willem Petzer.
Mm.
Willem Petzer, some YouTuber, I met him once, and he's a bit young, and you dislike him. He has a server that shares like that racist memes. I'm going to say they're racist. Some of them were Nazi memes. And then somehow there's a photo of him and Ernst at Ernst's book launch. And then somehow they want to lick Willem Petzer's server and racist memes to AfriForum. And then people complain. And then there's a rebuttal where they say, no, our initial intention was to link AfriForum to the server. So they're like just so blatant about trying to have this guilt by association. And it's not helping the citizen. And it's certainly not helping AfriForum at all, because who cares what other people say on their stupid server where you're not members?
But this is the thing that I don't understand, for example, about the citizen. So you would have seen about a month ago, we assisted a black farmer just outside Pretoria, Dr. Materemule.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome guy. He's actually a genius. He's a mathematician, a doctor, did all his studies in the States on bursaries and so on. Long story short, fact is,
sounds very interesting.
Yeah. He approached AfriForum. He said, look, the cops aren't helping me. None of the political parties are helping me. Is there a way that you can assist me? We said, sure. And I got my team together. I said, we have to help this guy. We need to make sure his land is saved. We need to, his property rights need to be protected. And we jumped in, and 2 weeks later, the Red Ants moved in. We had 800, 900 odd Red Ant workers move in. They broke down.
100?
Yeah.
Wow.
They walked in. In 3 hours, they removed 350 shacks, and they cleaned up the place. And the next day, on one of the pages of Citizen, there was an article that said, AfriForum comes to the rescue of black farmer. And then a few days later, they come with this racist meme thing. So I honestly think some of these media institutions have lost their own identity. I don't think they know what they want or where they're headed. They're not balanced at all. At least with the Huffington Post, you know, the majority of the stuff they write is completely prejudiced on some of the opinions they give. But then you get an institution like Citizen where you at least want to believe that they're going to give kind of a middle ground explanation
both
of something.
Sides.
Yeah.
Be fair.
And right. Then this totally unbalanced thing comes out where they write a great article where we did help a black farmer, where we are now friends after this whole thing that happened. And then 3 days later or a week later, they write that thing about Ernst and someone's racist memes. It just doesn't make sense.
But why do you think, I mean, speaking to you now, we see what you do. I mean, I approve as an anarchist. I think you're doing a great thing. Maybe I think Jonathan would agree with
community. I approve as a free market, too.
Right.
Free market anarchist.
That's me. That's me. Jonathan's a mercantile Jew, so I don't know if you can be
anarchist. Oh, goodness.
But why aren't those stories about you like coming out? Like personally, I think everyone has a messaging problem.
Yeah, well, this is the frustrating thing. You know, we always make sure we've got press releases. Look, every single day the important stories go out. And with Matsurumule's farm, I made a point of it to make sure that I personally inform many journalists on it and even phone them and tell them, listen, this is happening, because I know it's not reported on the way that it should be reported on. But if you take the same incident, or you take, let's rather say you have a coffin incident, I don't even want to compare the two because the one's positive, the other's negative, then you see the over-reporting because the criminal in the case is white. You know, so it's as though the stereotype kind of influences the way they report, because we make sure that we communicate it to the outside world. And if you go look at Afrikaans media, specifically Marula Media or Netwerk 24 or Beeld and any of those papers, you would see that they do get reported on accurately. But then certain, especially English media institutions, choose not to. It's as though they have been captured by someone. I don't know who, but they have been, and then they don't report accurately.
His initials are GNS, who they've been captured by. He donates money all over the world, all the time. Oh. He was mentioned in a recent Trump tweet.
Oh, who can't, sounds like Oros.
He who should not be named. No, that's conspiracy theory, but it's not so much captured. But you're correct. It's they push a certain agenda. I mean, I think some of this comes down to remembering that there's different individuals in media organizations, and so
that's
when
true.
you get a fair article written in The Citizen, for example, you've come across a fair journalist. You've come across, and let's remember, the person who wrote that article is an actual journalist. The person who wrote the memes article is not a journalist. So, as in, is not a trained journalist. Never went to journalism school. That's not their forte. So, the person who wrote the memes article happens to be a content manager.
And to come up for some of the journalists, sorry to interrupt you, but I have to mention it. To come up for some of the journalists is that I've phoned some of the journalists, for example, let's take News 24, and I said, listen, we gave you all of this information. You don't even give credit. Sorry, the editor removed it. So then I see a story, for example, AfriForum won a case a year ago where the cops had to make public how many firearms have they lost or had been stolen from them in an X amount of time. And then I see it being reported and say there was this court victory, but AfriForum's name isn't mentioned once, but the entire court case was driven by it. So then you have this editor kind of prejudice, but the ground level journalist very often does want to just tell an objective story.
That's what I've found. You know, I've got personal dealings with quite a few journalists, and the level of sort of, I wouldn't call it corruption, but the level of control that's being exerted at the editorial level is quite astonishing. And even the other day on Gareth Cliff's show, I mean, he has a feature every week called The Burning Platform, was hosted by Justice Malala before he managed to get his family out of the shithole into America. You know, he's currently being persecuted in Trump's America, but he went there with his entire family. And now every week it's usually hosted by a journalist. They get a guest journalist. And this past week, they got Simon Allison.
Simon Allison,
who is the African editor for the Mail and Guardian, and they, you know, he's a pleasant fellow, and they got chatting and a good insert, and it's always interesting, that insert. So I highly recommend it. But then they got to the part about Melania Trump coming to Africa, and he said, you know, I mean, go back and listen to it. You can call me out if I'm not telling the truth. He said that we don't care about Melania's trip, so we're not covering it. Now that's that's the editor, and Gareth pushed back a bit, and actually quite a lot, and said, yeah, but it's the first lady. It's her first trip ever. Yeah, but she doesn't care about Africa, he said. And Gareth is like, yeah, but it's her first trip, and she chose to come here. No, but, you know, and then Gareth said, but if it was Michelle Obama, you'd be covering it back to front. And he kind of spluttered over his words, and he didn't really know what to say. you know, that's kind of what's happening. Think about everything you can think of. I know of a science journalist who took a study that had been done in Europe where they had looked at various genetics and how genetics had informed disease. And some of the genetics that came from, that happened to come from black people, basically, but like we're talking about like historic stuff, you know, we're going back into the evolutionary stuff, had informed certain disease, and some of the stuff from traditionally, you know, Caucasians had informed other disease. Yeah. And it wasn't a persecution thing. They would not allow it to be included. They would not allow any kind of race stuff to be included. It's science. It's not making aspersions on anything, and it wasn't even making negative aspersions on any of the race groups. It was just simply stating sort of data findings, and this stuff is being excluded. So I think, you know, that's very important to understand. That's why we discussed it on the show. The reason why a show like this is quite popular, why alternative media is popular, why someone like Germs Cartoons are quite popular. You know, you guys have, I think Focus Films does a whole bunch of stuff as well, because it's a stuff that just isn't reaching anyone. It gets blocked before it gets there. Tell us quickly, because we haven't discussed it. There have been a couple of movies and films done on farm murders. You've got Lawrence Southern's one, which was...
It was called Farmlands, I believe.
Farmlands, that was it. And there was another one. There was Katie Hopkins.
Katie Hopkins. I can't remember what hers was. It was called Plas Murder, I believe it was called.
I don't even know what it was called. But yeah, Katie Hopkins. Right.
Yeah. Tell us what you think.
Well, I mean, let's give a bit of context. All right. So these are ostensibly international journalists who I mean, they both used to work for Rebel Media, who I don't really trust that much. They're a bit like right-wing out there, right-wing. Well, they should exist like everyone else. And there's a concentrated campaign by international right-wing media to talk about a white genocide in South Africa. I think Lawrence Southern has fallen into that hole a bit deeper than Katie Hopkins. I watch both. I think both have some merits, but... I found both to be rather derivative, and I don't trust both to be, you know, good documentaries in an objective sense. Not that they're meant to be objective. Maybe their point was to show that there's white genocide, and they've tried their best to portray that. But I understand that you met with Katie Hopkins. Ernst is in her documentary. So what do you make of these international journalists coming into Africa and trying to tell the story of farm murders for a global audience? Is it helping you? Is it detracting from you?
It depends from case to case. I mean, I think of Paul Toohey and Gary Ramage from Australia that visited earlier this year. And they were actually the ones that sparked this international outcry or almost outrage about farm attacks in the country. And we've received, and predominantly from traditionally liberal media, a lot of communication where people want to tell the stories, and very positive stories even in our favor have been told throughout the world from German media, Japanese media, American media. Really well-balanced stories have been told. So regarding their documentaries, I think it's a dangerous game to play, because I think it has the threat of creating a misperception of what's happening. From my point of view, and I guess if it's possible for Get Afri Forum side, if I were just to look at it from the outside completely, Katie Hopkins, for example, in one of her crowdfunding videos, I told you earlier about it, you know, she suddenly starts running and shots are being fired all around her, and she's got bodyguards taking her to the car, and then the next moment she pops out saying, luckily that was just a drill, but this is the reality on farms in South Africa.
That's proper fake news.
Yeah, it's utter nonsense. I mean, it just doesn't happen that way, and the sad thing is it creates a total misperception of what really is happening. Now, the lucky thing is I think a lot of people, especially in the media, know Katie Hopkins and they kind of see through this, but it does create a wrong idea of what's happening, and that creates damage to our cause. So I very often on Twitter, as you said earlier, not often, now and then I would post a picture of a victim of a farm attack. I never put photos up of dead bodies or whatever. I'd put a face up of someone lying in hospital being bruised.
Or or you know, a scene with blood and
yeah.
You know, I think you put one of that little girl who was raped.
Exactly.
It wasn't the little girl or anything, but there was a child's piece of clothing or something.
And, yeah, her and a toys whole bunch were lying of, there and blood against and, the wall.
I mean, very disturbing stuff.
Yeah. Mm. So I do put that up occasionally, and it's not to desensitize people, because I take that into consideration, because if people see too much of that, they kind of start looking at it as just another Saw movie, and it's important that people have compassion and so on. And I'm a strong believer that we need to tell every single victim's story, because otherwise people just become a statistic. It's a South African disease actually when it comes to crime. But the danger about these people is that when they go and speak in an international arena, and a lot of the very far right wing groups in South Africa have done this, they take these graphic photos and they go and share photos of dead bodies and people have them chopped up and horrible things. And those photos weren't even in South Africa. You know, there was a video that was being spread about a month ago in South Africa of a woman being beheaded. And a lot of people said this is a farm attack and this happened in KwaZulu-Natal. And meanwhile, it was a drug cartel in Brazil that had kidnapped someone, and the video started spreading on social media. You can hear them speaking in a completely different language in the background. Mm. And people started sharing this. And this is the danger of not being balanced, not confirming something. When we report on something, when I report something on Twitter, I am 99.8% convinced that is right. And when I say there might be a 0.2% difference, the reason for that is I sometimes might have said the guy was stabbed once instead of being stabbed 10 times, you know. So those are the types of difference. We make sure that when we report something, it is confirmed on the ground with either a victim or someone on scene.
Yeah, so, I mean, unfortunately, these people keep coming back to South Africa to try and make these stories. I mean, do they contact you for assistance?
They've contacted me a lot. I can talk about Katie Hopkins and my steps towards her. Is that never had an argument with her or anything. She was very nice to me, and she's a very, very, very nice person to
affable.
To talk to and have coffee or whatever. But you know, what she started doing is that she wanted to see victims. And I think there are two things. First of all, she started realizing that we don't necessarily fit in with the agenda she's trying to promote. And so she kind of gave everyone a cold shoulder and started doing her own thing, which is good. And then on top of that, I started getting the feeling that, you know, every time before she would meet with a farm attack victim, the night before she would cancel or try and postpone. And these victims were preparing themselves psychologically to have these encounters and share their stories. And the next moment, someone cancels. So by the third or fourth time I asked her, I said, listen, I think we're going to cancel all of them. We can't disappoint these people even further. And so that was my impression of it. Mm. Lauren Southern, when we come back to her, unfortunately, a lot of the things that she has said or mentioned is completely sensational. Some of the statistics that she gives are way off. The figures that they share with the world regarding the amount of people that have been killed or murdered, have been murdered or attacked, is way off. And I don't know where they get these figures from.
So, you know, my sense on a lot of these things is that perhaps it's difficult, and we should try not to sort of say too much about other people's motives if we don't know. But I think that you can sort of glean a little bit from how they behave and what they do. So, for example, Lauren Southern releases farmlands, and also at the same time wants you to kind of follow her and donate and et cetera, et cetera. And I think she is kind of an issue journalist, so she follows the issues. Sometimes she does a good job, sometimes she could do better. But certainly when you're doing that, you've got to try present as best as you possible, I suppose, to an audience. And when you're presenting to an audience, the same as CNN, when they present to an audience, you know, when they're standing in a hurricane, they're going to pretend that the hurricane's blowing them over while two guys walk in the background, you know, with no problem carrying a six pack to their truck. So, I think that that's where the sensationalism comes in, because if it's not almost entertainment and you're not kind of proving the worst case scenario, then I'd rather watch about the other genocide happening in somewhere else, or the other issue journalist doing a story on something worse.
For sure.
Yeah, is it more hazard, it's the moral hazard question I asked Adams when he was here. The moral hazard for AfriForum is that expropriation of that compensation is a big issue to fight against, and it's very popular with your members, and you keep getting a lot of new members. And my question to him at the time was, when do you become populist on the opposition to it instead of factual and strategic? And I think these Katie Hopkins, Lawrence said they've become very populist on the agenda and are skimming, you know, over the facts, or what they're not telling is more important than what they are telling, if that makes sense. And I think for AfriForum, that I think the moral hazard might still appear sooner or later for all of us. For all of us, our podcast with France and Ernst, and when you speak about expropriation, we get like record downloads. So it's a moral hazard for us as well. But as long as we're honest and truthful about it, that's what we care about.
A Katie Hopkins and a Lawrence Southern that say things and sweeping statements and generalize about things or just act sensational. And so it sounds like I'm almost victimizing them now. But just as an example, are doing one and the same thing as some of the journalists here when they say that AfriForum is a you know, what was today, apartheid modern nationalist organization, you know, that type of. I was just astounded to see this. So they're doing one and the same thing. It's just a different agenda. But that's the two true. Are actually just giving each other more ammo to fire up their own agendas. And the people in the middle, the balanced, you know, type of person is just watching this tennis game going on and shots being fired towards each other.
How do we empower that centrist to become, not militant, but like to fight? Like I was on Ronaldo Jose's live stream a few weeks ago. And I said, listen, chaps. Expropriating our compensation is our Rubicon. If this goes through, we are screwed as a country. We're going to be Venezuela in 5 years. That's easy. People are fighting against it. AfriForum, Institute of Race Relations, we are some people in the DA. Like, you have to fight for your rights in a democracy. Be a Democrat, fight for your rights. Don't be afraid to actually stand up for your rights. And if you bully the ANC, they're going to fall over. But you need to stand up and do it. And I don't know, how do you think as AfriForum you can actually get people to understand that they're not just slaves or they're not just serfs? They are active citizens and they should actually be active.
I think it's having people take off the covers off their eyes to realize that they can actually do something. You know, we've realized that with neighborhood watches and farm watches in the country, a lot of people didn't realize, wow, I am actually allowed to perform an arrest. I must just understand how to do it and how to, you know, decrease my risk and that I do have the support to get through this. And once we did that, we see these organizations or ground level groups skyrocketing in growth. So it's important that people know that there are ways to do it. I think the challenge that we have at the moment is the wheels in South Africa are coming off very quickly. And in order to get to the different issues on time and you know, have some form of legitimate resistance is very difficult. And then you still have the political arguments of who has what agenda. So that makes it tough. What I've realized is that we must never and maybe I'm wrong, maybe someone can prove me wrong, and I believe it's been different in other countries, but in South Africa what I've found is that it's always a smaller group that eventually really do influence the actual decision that is made. We saw with Pretoria's name change, you know, the one meeting I attended, there were about 700 ANC members and we were 10 guys from AfriForum sitting there, and at the end they were spitting at us and shouting and swearing and whatever. And what we did is across the city, we organized buses to go to these meetings, and we ended up filling up the last meetings completely, where AfriForum members ended up being the majority in some of the meetings, and they'd never changed the name.
Yeah. You use the tactics against them.
You know, the way I've started to look at it is a lot of people, maybe ostrich in the sand is one way, but if you think of a road, and on the left-hand side, there's a pavement sidewalk, and you know that's the people on the left, and on the right-hand side, another pavement or sidewalk, and that's the people on the right. And in the middle, it depends on how politically active your community is. So obviously your pavement increases on either side the more politically involved the populace is. But in South Africa, we almost have this pavement or sidewalk on either side and a highway, a six-lane highway in the middle of it. And the rest of the country, so we're on one or the other side, The rest of the country's standing in the middle of this highway, but they don't know they're on a highway. They have no idea there are cars and trucks coming for them. And I've had discussions with people quite recently. One who said, why do you care about all this stuff? It doesn't matter. So that's someone who's literally like, he knows he's on a road, but he's kind of just turned his back to traffic. And if it hits him, he'll deal with it then, right? And then someone else who, I recently sat down with and said, you think the world's getting better or worse? And they said, no, definitely worse. And I said, all right, well, let's look at poverty, extreme poverty. We can look at many stats, but extreme poverty is one. I think it's worse or better or the same than it was, say, 30 years ago. And they said, no, way worse. And I said, well, actually, it's way better. It's more than halved. and they were like, no, I don't believe it. And I was like, no, it's not about belief. This isn't a belief
this
thing.
Is factual.
I will give you the data. Like, I'll just give you the data. No, the data must be wrong, they said to me. So, those are the people standing on the road who can see the cars coming, but they're saying, I'm not on a road. That's not a car. That's a mirage. And I'm actually, I'm standing in my garden. There's no way I'm going to get hit by
that. It's that Winston Churchill Hitler argument. He says he's going to kill people. And then you say, that's not what he meant. Peter de Toy Ramaphosa, there are no farm attacks in South Africa just after four people had been slaughtered inside a house. Sure. And then Peter de Toy comes and says, sorry, it was out of context. That's not really what he meant. And I'm like, listen, China. Yeah.
Another issue is that people just don't understand the National Democratic Revolution. AfriForum does, IR does, we do. I don't know if Helen Zilla does now. But what it does and what they've been very good at doing is isolating sectors and then just hammering them. So they hammer the mining sector. The mining sector pushes back, but only in the mining sector. They hammer EWC, the farmers push back, but the farmers only deal within that paradigm created by the ANC. Yeah. They don't see the thread, the golden thread of the NDR going throughout all of these policies and all of this ideology.
You slowly destroy each industry or get it in line with your beliefs.
Indeed. And I find that there's a disjunction between the different sectors and institutions actually just coming together against the NDR.
It's the boiling frog principle, It's just slowly but surely the frog is dying, but he's not really feeling it. So, and that's another reason why I think the balanced individual doesn't always realize how important it is that they act, because I don't think they always realize how bad things have gotten.
Yeah, and they're going to get much worse unless we act. But Ian, it's bloody well 7 o'clock on a Friday night.
Yes.
And I know for myself, I have a wife.
Do you?
Or two.
News.
Maybe.
A whole harem of wives.
A whole harem. It's my Arab culture. And I think, Ian, you married, and Jonathan, you married. So I think we should get back to our wives, to Netflix and chill.
I should be so lucky.
We can discuss that off air. We'll create a new podcast about how to deal with
man's man podcast.
Dr. Love.
Right. Oh, goodness.
Dr. Love.
I think we should call it there while we're going straight off course here.
Ian, what an absolute pleasure to speak to you. It's been really helpful. I think that you are doing a great service for this country, AfriForum, and you specifically as well. And it's good to know that, that people like you are there. For the record, I'm not a member of AfriForum. They don't accept Jews, so Jonathan's not a member.
Of course they don't.
No worry, I wasn't one either till recently. So.
Oh, really? Even though you work for them?
Yeah, I didn't ever realize. But thank you very much. It's awesome chatting. Yeah,
So if people want to assist or join, I suppose they're just going to afriforum.co.za.
Afriforum.co.za. And if they want to follow Farm Attacks, I try to update as regularly as possible. I've also got a team that assists with that. Is Ian Cameron 23 on Twitter, and if they follow that, then we can chat, and I can also maybe if they've got an inquiry, also answer that for them.
Cool.
Perfect.
That's excellent. And if this is the first time you're listening to the show, thank you for listening. And please go have a look at our catalog of episodes. Well over 100 shows you can possibly download with interesting people from all different viewpoints.
Yeah. And importantly, you'll notice there are no adverts on the show. And I think we actually prefer it that way. So we are crowdfunded by listeners. We are on Patreon at patreon.com/renegadereport. Support us financially. You know, you use the power of your money to change the battle of ideas in this country, and we will fight on your behalf with absolute pleasure.
Yeah,
we've been doing so for 2.5 years for no pay, by the way, and we don't expect to be paid. But it'll be good to get donations so we can make the podcast better. We're hoping to get video soon. We're hoping to get roaming mics so we can actually travel in the country and interview people on the ground for the series that we have planned. So if you like us, you like this sort of conversation, please help us out on patreon.com/renegadereport.
And just for the month of October, last little bit of ad stuff is we're running a t-shirt competition. You can win $200 and this total of about $350 in prize money. Basically, we just want a design of a cool t-shirt. So ask me about my feminist agenda, for example. That would look quite funny on me. If you have a shirt like that, if you have any kind of idea for a shirt that's funny social political commentary or just top kick, that would be great. And yeah, as always, you can find us on Twitter at @Renegade_Report, Ramon at @RomanKavanagh, myself at @Jonathan_Witt, the Facebook pages as well. If you're using iTunes or the Google Play Store, please like us and leave us a review. Thanks so much. We'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.